members in good standing, which means they've paid dues. They've paid up. Of these, roughly 10 or 15% could be understood to be active. That is, they attend the monthly membership meetings, which are hybrid. They're largely in person, but with an online attendance as well. Also, these folks are involved in one or another working group of the chapter. I've begun attending the monthly meetings in person, and when I'm there, I generally see between 50 and 80 participants at each meeting. This translates into a national total of, I would say, 8,000 to 10,000 active DSA members, which is still a substantial force. It's bigger than any other group on the left, the U.S. left at the present time. Now, then I can go, based on what I saw at the convention in Chicago, and there were about 1,500 people in attendance, almost all of whom were members of DSA, over 1,200 of whom were elected delegates. The age range was overwhelmingly on the young side, perhaps a few teenagers, I don't know, but mostly folks in their 20s and 30s, and some in their 40s. Those in their 50s and 60s were relatively fewer in number, and then there was only a sprinkling of people like me in their 70s and 80s. While a majority of those at the convention could be identified as white, there were significant numbers of Hispanic, African, South Asian, East Asian, and Middle Eastern folks of that extraction. So it wasn't all white, but it was a majority white. The gender balance struck me as fairly even, although there seemed to be a far greater percentage than usual of those identifying as trans and non-binary. What especially stood out for me, Jim, was that the great majority of those who were present seemed to understand themselves to be part of the working class, an occupationally diverse working class, but working class, and that class identity seemed to be central to the discussions at the convention.
Paul, this is Michael Smith. Who were the main speakers at the convention, and what was the most notable about their remarks?
Sure. One thing to understand is this was a working convention, so that it wasn't lots of different speakers. It was people, you know, dealing with business and all kinds of procedural motions and counter motions and so forth and so on. But there were some speakers, and the keynote speaker was Rashida Tlaib, and she gave an incredibly radical speech, and the convention delegates responded to it with immense enthusiasm. It was a very left-wing speech. You can hear it online, by the way. I urge everyone to go online, look up Rashida Tlaib, DSA Convention 2025, and listen to the speech. It was an amazing speech. It was very critical of the Democratic Party establishment as well as the Republican Party establishment. It was very much critical of the State of Israel and the Zionist regime there, uncompromisingly defending Palestinian rights and linking that to realities that workers and the oppressed in this country are experiencing. It was a very, very radical speech, and it was a very popular speech. There were two other sessions where it wasn't mostly procedure and voting and motions and so forth. There was a panel of presentations by key organizers of Zoran Mamdani's mayoral campaign in New York City. One aspect of it, the major aspect of it, was going through how they did it, the kind of organizing, the quality of organizing, the intensity of organizing that was carried out to win this remarkable victory. In that panel presentation, there was a little bit of time for discussion, and the few questions were focused on what now? Assume that he wins the election and that he's the mayor of New York. What's he going to do? to carry through on the program that he was winning so many voters on. And it was a very fine program. And again, you can look that up online, and you can look up his campaign speeches online. But what's he going to do when he's negotiating with the New York City police, for example? And what's he going to do when he's facing opposition, not only from the Trump administration and from the GOP, but also from the Democratic Party establishment? I thought the answers were fairly honest in that people said, I don't know. I'm concerned about that too. We'll have to see. It was a good discussion, very informative. There was another 3-hour session that was very dynamic, and I didn't think it would work, but it worked great. It was billed as the first ever cross-organizational political exchange, and there were contributions by some DSA members, but mostly from folks in various unions, teachers union, and the rank and file caucus of the electrical workers, a group called Essential Workers for Democracy, and a rank and file caucus of the National Association of Letter Carriers and Railroad Workers United, and Arise Chicago Workers Center, and the Debt Collective and the Sunrise Movement, and also actually people from groups outside of the United States, both the Brazilian Workers Party, the PT, and also PSOL, which is a very large opposition party in Brazil, and La France Insoumise, Morena from France, and Morena from Mexico, and Puerto Rican activists and Japanese activists. So each one of these people spoke for 2 minutes, and I thought it was maybe going to be a hodgepodge, but it was eloquent, it was moving, and the different pieces fit together beautifully. In any event, those were the speakers, Rashida Tlaib, the panel on Mamdani's campaign, and then this political exchange.
Paul, let's now discuss what I understand to have been three main political blocks of delegates at the convention. First, I understand, for example, that there was what we might describe as the moderate wing. Tell us about this block or group of DSA members, and then we'll get to the others.
The moderate wing, my understanding, had been the dominant force in DSA for some time. And the two largest caucuses that make it up at this point are the Socialist Majority Caucus and an even larger Groundwork Caucus. And they're in favor of electoral activity, working inside the Democratic Party, various other things, some of which, others agree with, but they're more moderate for sure. That is the moderate caucus. And they received altogether, the two of them together, 9 of the seats of the National Political Committee that was elected at the convention, which is a minority.
Paul, the second block of delegates can be described as the far left. How would you define what they mean by far left?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in my article, I used that breakdown, and I took it over from someone else who had named Stephen Kimmerly. It's worth reading his report also, which you can see online. But the left wing of the organization, which got over the overwhelming majority of votes for the National Political Committee, could be divided into two pieces. And so one is the far left caucus, which is in some ways inclined to be less compromising than the other left wing elements. Also, some of them tend to be uncritical or much less critical of countries and movements that are opposed to U.S. imperialism or perceived to be opposed to U.S. imperialism. And this includes the government of China, the government of Russia, and various other entities, various social movements, some of which are quite authoritarian and some of which are even anti-socialist, but they're also against U.S. imperialism. So those are characteristics of at least many of the so-called far-left caucus. I should add, by the way, it's not hard and fast. That is, there are many people in the left wing of the organization, which is now the majority of the organization, that are inclined to be critical of certain positions of the far left, and there are some that are less critical. So it's a fluid situation.
Well, Paul, there was also a group of delegates, though, which orientate strongly towards the mass of working class people in this country, with the aim of building an independent socialist party. I wonder, how big a block was that group at the convention? Did they represent a majority of those attending, or among the broad members of the DSA in general?
Yeah, I think that's a very good and important question. The others on the left, and actually most of the caucuses, have a basically Marxist orientation, and that includes the moderates, and utilize that kind of language. All of them, I at least claim that they want to see a mass socialist movement and mass working class involvement. And the question is how to get there and how to accomplish that and how quickly and what kinds of alliances should be taking place. But in any event, there were several caucuses, Bread and Roses, the Marxist Unity Group, Reform and Revolution, and others, that are in that grouping that you're referring to. But it's important to recognize they're not the only ones that want to see a mass independent socialist movement. The question is how to get there and how quickly we can get there.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio, and we're speaking with an old friend, Paul LeBlanc, who just came back from the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, convention in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. Paul, I understand that there were a number of debates, principal debates, at the convention with the aim of building an independent socialist party. How big a block was that group at the convention? Did they represent a majority of those attending?
I think so, but it's not entirely clear. That is to say, an independent bloc, you know, that is in favor of a break from the Democratic Party, that is majority sentiment for sure. But how quickly that can be accomplished and by what route that can be accomplished, there are some differences. That was one of the issues. Another of the issues in the principal debates were what is the appropriate stance to take on Israel and Zionism and Palestine. And again, there's a great majority, overwhelming majority, that is against the Netanyahu policies in Palestine, is hostile to Zionism as involving ethnic cleansing and exclusionary realities, a form of apartheid. There is broad agreement on that. But what about those people who are progressive Democrats or even in some cases DSA members who compromise on that in Congress, in their votes, in what they say, and so forth? What should the attitude be? And increasingly, there was an attitude, candidates who are endorsed by DSA and have the support of DSA should be open socialists, should identify in a positive way with DSA, should be on the side of the Palestinians in and opposed to the genocide being carried out by the Israeli regime. And those who do not measure up to that standard should not be supported by DSA. There are some delegates who were not inclined to support that position. It won. That position, those positions won at the convention. But there were significant numbers of people who were concerned about, you know, would this fracture DSA, would this fracture its base? And so that was one of the points of contention, it seemed to me.
Well, Paul, there was also a debate finally at the convention over how close the DSA should adhere to its own core socialist principles. Talk to us a bit that debate.
Yeah, I've talked about it briefly in some of my earlier comments, and some of the debate was not finally drawn. There wasn't a rigidity to the positions, but there was agreement on the part of a majority, from what I could see, that DSA should be supporting socialist candidates, not simply progressives, not pro-capitalist, liberal pro-capitalist candidates. And there was also a motion that passed that for the 2028 presidential convention, DSA should be exploring the possibility of finding a socialist candidate for president, you know, who will be for socialism and talk about those kinds of issues. That is similar to the candidacy of Zoran Mamdani. That's what he did. And also Rashida Tlaib. So I think there is majority sentiment to go more in that direction. That leaves up in the air the question of the relationship of DSA to the Democratic Party. And that is something that wasn't clearly resolved at the convention.
What is your personal thinking about what the relationship of the DSA should be to the Democratic Party?
I think the kind of criticism that Rashida Tlaib made in her keynote address is absolutely appropriate, and that is a denunciation of the Democratic Party establishment. I think at the same time that it's important not to fragment the movement. And so I am looking forward to learning from the comrades in DSA, both positive and negative lessons on how to deal with that. Ultimately, the Democratic Party, which is a capitalist party, and it's recognized as a capitalist party by a majority of DSA members, is incompatible with what, as a capitalist party, it is incompatible with what DSA stands for. And so that is a contradiction and a dilemma that has to be faced by DSA. That's as far as I can go at this point on that important question.
And Paul, I understand there was also apparently a focus on the DSA running its own candidates, and not just endorsing liberal or progressive candidates of any other party. Am I right about that?
Yes, that is a majority, certainly a majority position. I don't know if everyone in the moderate wing would agree with that, but large numbers of us have that point of view.
What does the party do if somebody who accepts endorsement from the DSA then goes off the rails? Was that kind of a discussion had at the convention?
That was a discussion that was had in some ways. And should they be, if they happen to be a member of DSA, should they be expelled from DSA? Should DSA openly denounce them? There's not agreement on that. The pro-Palestinian anti-Zionist resolution that passed by a clear majority seemed to some people to involve a possibility of denunciations and expulsions, and there isn't an appetite for that in the organization. But that is a question that is definitely posed.
Paul, I wonder, there is a great deal, of course, of national attention on the mayor's race of New York City for obvious reasons, largest city of the country, Cuomo being a candidate, and yet there is this come-behind victory of Zoran Mamdani. I gather there was considerable discussion at the convention on the role that the DSA would play in that race. Talk to us a bit about that.
Sure. There wasn't as much discussion about that in the regular proceedings, the business part of the meeting. But of course, there was an entire panel devoted to that, and there's been plenty of informal discussion as well. Mamdani's race would not have happened without DSA. Zoran Mamdani is considered a cadre of DSA. He has been a state senator in the New York legislature. He has played an active role not only in the legislature, but then in consulting DSA, and he's in favor of that kind of thing. There were ongoing consultations and ongoing involvement by DSAers in New York in the race. It wouldn't have happened otherwise. That's what I can tell you about that. There's questions about what should happen in other cities, and there are some similar efforts, like in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and elsewhere, going in the direction of the Mamdani campaign. But the Mamdani campaign, in any event, has that contradiction. On the one hand, he was running as a Democrat in the Democratic Party, and he was running as an open socialist, going in a direction that is not supported by the Democratic Party establishment. So that is something that people are dealing with and discussing and debating, at least informally.
How can our listeners learn more about the DSA? And also, how can they follow your many writings?
Well, I'm glad you asked. And there are several things that people can do. Those who use computers should go online and go to the DSA website, and also to the websites of various DSA caucuses, and they will learn a lot from that. And the websites also, and videos where Rashida Tlaib and Zoran Mamdani are explaining their views, I think that would be useful. There is a book that was just recently published that I contributed to. It's a big fat book and a useful book, A User's Guide to DSA. And you can go online to order that, and it contains about 30 different presentations from major DSA activists from a variety of caucuses and perspectives. And that gives a good sense of much of the thinking and discussion in the organization. In terms of my writings, you had said at the beginning, many of them have been appearing in Lynx, an international journal of socialist renewal. Also in the site Communis, not communist and not communism, you dropped the last letter there, but Communis. Communis is going to be bringing out an edition of some of my writings and thinking. There's one other book that is put out by Pluto Press called Lenin, Responding to Catastrophe, Forging Revolution, in which I try to explore the relevance of Lenin's thinking and activity and the meaning of it, not only historically, but also how it may relate to things that we're facing today. So those are some things.
Well, Paul LeBlanc, it's been a real pleasure for Jim and I to have you on Law and Disorder. You know, on a personal aside, I've known you for 50 years, even when in the old days when you were in SDS. And now you've been a professor, retired professor. Your writings are terrific. And I urge people to plug in to Paul LeBlanc. The book you mentioned, A User's Guide to the DSA, is excellent. You've got an excellent article in it. I've just read it. And I appreciate your being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Paul.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. For archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Attorney Mel Wolf died at age 95 on July 1, 2023. He was one of the greatest constitutional litigators of his time. He served as legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union for 15 years. Today, we bring you a rebroadcast of an interview that attorney Michael Ratner and I, Michael Smith, did with Mel 10 years ago for a segment we called Lawyers You'll Like. It's a scintillating, fast-paced discussion with a relevance to our situation now. Give a listen. For this segment of Lawyers You'll Like, we're pleased to be joined by attorney Mel Wolf, former legal director of the ACLU. In his long career, Mel represented some of the most important civil rights movements and groups in the United States. Today we'll talk to him about the AG case, where he tried to get Phil Agee's passport back, his work in the Deep South in the 60s, representing Mississippi Summer in 1964, and numerous other cases he argued before the Supreme Court. He has remarkable opinions on the court today and the court of yesterday, as well as what's happened to civil liberties in the United States. Mel Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
You bet.
Mel, throughout my career, I'm a little younger than you, you've been one of the, quote, lawyers I like, and I want our listeners to say you're one of the lawyers they like. So here we are for a segment on Mel Wolf and lawyers you'll like. Now, you've been had a long history, 15 years, I think, as legal director of the ACLU.
At least.
It felt like more, I know, Mel. But the case I want to start with, and then we'll go back to some of your remarkable history, is the Phil Agee case. Phil Agee was, of course, a former CIA agent who wrote a book called Inside the Company, revealed a couple hundred names of CIA people.
All over South and Central America.
All over. So, and the reason I want to bring it up first is because recently I got a request saying, Michael, you know, the U.S. took away the passport from Ed Snowden. So he's sitting in Moscow without a U.S. passport. And they said, can't we bring a lawsuit to get Ed Snowden's passport back? And I just typed them four letters, AG. So why don't you tell us about why Ed Snowden would have a very tough time getting his passport.
Well, he would, because Phil Agee, as you said, was a dissident CIA agent who spent decades working against the CIA, published a couple of books, a political memoir, Inside the Company, which you referred to. But he lost his passport because when the dissidents took over the American embassy in Tehran
in 79,
the New York Post carried a story accusing Phil of helping the students who had invaded the embassy to put together all that written material that had been shredded.
How could he do that?
Well, he didn't do it. It was a total, you know, another New York Post lie, bald-faced lie. And in any case, the State Department, based upon that story, revoked his passport. He was then living in Hamburg, actually, as he had been for a while. Anyhow, they revoked his passport, and we started. I had been representing Agee for a long time. I was his principal lawyer for 30 years, and had received a total of $1,500 in fees from my 30 years representation.
Blood money, Mel.
From an
$0.50 a year,
and that was from the government. The government paid me for an FOIA case that I did for Phil. In any case, they revoked his passport on national security grounds, and we started a lawsuit, and we went to the district court. District of Columbia. We won it there based upon a U.S. Supreme Court decision some years earlier on behalf of Kent. What was Kent's
Rockwell
first?
Rockwell Kent. Famous U.S. artist.
Yeah, Leonard Boudin was his left-wing artist. And they had taken his passport away for political reasons, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional that they couldn't revoke his passport for the national security reasons given. So we thought we were in the catbird seat and started an action for Phil. We won it in the district court, and the government appealed, and we won it again in the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. And then finally, the government appealed, went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court, they couldn't get Agee. So they got his lawyer instead, and they really gave me a really, really hard time in that argument.
Really?
And they reversed them. They reversed Kent. They said Kent doesn't apply in this case, and they didn't say exactly why, because it did apply, obviously. But they voted 6-3. Agee was very widely disliked in Washington because he was well known to be a CIA dissident who had disclosed the names of lots and lots of CIA agents. And he wasn't much liked in the Washington community. Anyhow, they stood the Kent decision on its head and by a vote of 6-3 upheld the State Department's withdrawal of cancellation of Phil's passport. And I dare say if Snowden went the same route today, he would do even worse in this Supreme Court than I did, which was a 6-3 vote. And that's why Snowden won't get his passport back. Thanks to me.
We're talking to Attorney Mel Wolf, a lawyer you'll like. And Mel, it strikes me and Michael that you're rare in a lot of respects, particularly this one, that unlike Michael and me, you're a 50s radical. We would call ourselves 60s radical, but you got like a half a generation on us. And
more than that, I think.
Not much more.
And I'm going to be 86 next week.
Congratulations.
I wanted to get that in.
The generation 20 years or 30 years, Mel?
Don't know.
Well, any case, how did a guy get your great sensibilities coming up in the 50s out of Troy, New York?
Well, it's you're asking me for deep psychoanalytic insights, which I don't have.
You could be superficial.
And I don't. no doubt I will be. My family were owners of a business in Troy, and I worked. They made men's clothing, and I worked in the factory often, and I got to know the guys who worked on the floor and the cutting room and the women who worked on the sewing machines. And somehow or other, I don't know why, I sort of preferred the guys who were working on the floor rather than my father and his brothers who were working in the front office. I was for the worker and not for the bosses. And I've always been for the workers and not for the bosses, which I think is the distinguishing political factor in our world today. Which side are you on? That was the basic background for the development, I think, of my left liberal, quasi-radical attitudes towards American political life.
How come you decided to go to law school?
I did it to avoid being drafted during the Korean War. Actually.
Oh, same with me.
Korean War?
We're talking Vietnam. Oh. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, same war.
Yeah.
Every year there's a draft. So, I mean, there was.
Every year there's a war.
Right, that's
I got my bachelor's degree in 52, and I had a Navy commission, which I had gotten from the New York State Maritime Academy some years earlier on. But the Maritime Academy didn't count as military service because the Merchant Marine did not. And my draft board sent me a 1A notice, so I applied to law school. I went to Columbia. And when I finished Columbia, they sent me another 1A notice because the draft was still on. So I activated my commission. I spent 2 years in the Navy as a lieutenant junior grade officer in Southern California, actually.
I didn't know that. Well, let's bring you from Southern California to Southern America, because that's early 60s. There's the height of the Civil Rights Movement.
It was the beginning of the heights of the Civil Rights Movement. And I was at that time, I went to work at the ACLU in 1958 as assistant legal director. In 1962, I was given the job of the legal director of the ACLU. And the summer of 64, I had actually been going down to Mississippi from 1961 to 62, working with then one of the two black lawyers who were practicing in Mississippi, a wonderful guy named R.J.S. Brown, who worked out of Jackson. And he and I, he called the ACLU out of the blue once, and I responded. And he had a capital case, and he wanted some help. And I went down to Jackson, tried that case with him, and I was barely. To call me a trial lawyer was a vast overstatement. But in any case, we went ahead and we tried a couple of Jess and I tried a couple of capital cases together around Mississippi, in Jackson or Philadelphia, and in Vicksburg, I remember. And I continually argued the question of systematic exclusion of blacks from the jury. And I finally got a case up to the Mississippi Supreme Court on that issue. And I said, if you don't do it, the federal courts will. And they said, sit down, Mr. Wolf. We've heard enough from you. But the fact of the matter is that for 12 or 15 years, because of the work that Jess and I did on the exclusion issue, and actually the Supreme Court of Mississippi threw out the conviction that I had argued and asked them to, and they had asked me to sit down. For 12 or 15 years, there was not an execution in Mississippi of any African American, because of they conceded that the exclusion tainted every conviction, and they weren't going to change it. So instead of giving these black guys a death penalty, they just sentenced them to life without parole. But it was a step in the right direction.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a famous incident that happened at Columbia. I went to Columbia as well, but we had James Meredith in the class, who was the first black man to desegregate University of
Mississippi.
So there was a case that came up, and a black guy who had accused of raping a white woman in Mississippi or something, had only gotten life imprisonment. The professor says to the class, why do you think that black man only got life in prison? And Meredith raises his hand and says, because he was innocent. So it's a great anecdotal Columbia story.
In any case, then summer of 64 was coming upon us. You all remember,
sure,
summer 64 voter registration project. We had heard that the Guild was starting a program to see if they could find some lawyers around the country who would go down and help out during the summer, the Mississippi summer. And we at the ACLU thought that was a terrific idea, and that we would do it also. And we weren't going to do it in conjunction with the Guild, because the ACLU and the Guild were sort of get on very well.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, the Guild was looked at by many people, including some of your colleagues at the ACLU, as a communist front.
Yeah.
And they were worried that the Guild was getting a foothold, because the Communist Party had been active in desegregation for many years in the South.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And so they looked at the Guild as that. And then I remember, because I was a part of the Guild.
Well, the ACLU had a terrible history of anti-communism.
They threw Elizabeth Gurley Flynn is different.
Off the board because she was CP,
right.
And they had a long, despicable position on CPers within the ACLU. Anyhow, that was, and the Guild looked at the ACLU as sort of a bunch of bourgeois liberals, which we were. although I must say that I was invited to speak, to give the main speech at a Guild annual meeting in Washington. When was it? In the 70s, I think. And Joe Rao, you remember Joe
Rao? Sure, I knew Joe.
Did you work with Joe?
Sure.
Joe got in touch with the executive director and wanted to have me fired because I spoke to the Guild.
Wow.
I mean, Joe Rao, now dead, was not a real civil libertarian. He never represented a member of the CP during all of his years.
Right.
Before UAC and those, he represented only people who were not members of the CP.
I want to say something in defense of the Guild, Michael and Mel. The original idea for the Guild to go down south in 64 was the idea of Ernie Goodman, who was not a member of the Communist Party, and on various issues stood up against the Communist Party inside of the Guild.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Ernie that organized that. And in fact, the national office of the Lawyers Guild moved from New York, which was more oriented towards the CP, to Detroit, where Ernie had a major law firm.
Picking up on the fact that the Guild was starting this summer project, we started the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee,
right,
and did to duplicate what they were doing. And I think we ended up enlisting a lot more lawyers than the Guild actually did. We had several hundred lawyers who went down to Mississippi for summer for periods of a week or two. 2, sometimes longer.
What did the committee do, or what did the Guild committee, what was their work? I mean, they weren't doing death penalty
Well,
cases.
Everybody, no, they were just representing people arrested in Mississippi during Mississippi summer. And they were, none of them were members of the Mississippi Bar, obviously. But most of the courts, and particularly the federal courts, particularly in the Northern District, the guy in the Southern District was a real fascist guy.
Who was Cox? Was that in the Southern District?
Cox was in the Southern District, yeah. That's right. Yeah. No, he was a terrible guy.
He was a bad guy.
Anyhow, a lot of these, most of the judges allowed these out-of-state lawyers to come and make some sort of presentation. But it wasn't so much their role as lawyers that was important for those lawyers. It was their seeing what Mississippi was like back in 1964, you know, when it was like the Third Reich.
It still has some problems.
It was said some years ago that Mississippi, in fact, had more elected black officials than any other state in the union, actually.
Yeah, well, there's
so
a
you
got
to give them credit for something.
Well,
anyhow, that was Mississippi summer. And
well, Mel, proceeding along, I know you've argued 10 cases before the United States Supreme Court.
I did.
And I wanted to ask you
first your win and loss record, which is the main thing we're worried about.
I can't remember.
Well,
it was about half and half.
When Bill Kuessler was asked that question, he said, "Better than Willie Mays, half and half isn't bad, given the kind of cases that you would take, Mel." Let's talk about some of those cases and some of the judges that you got entangled with. Well, one was the SDS case. I think you mentioned earlier.
Yes, I in fact argued one, the only case argued in the Supreme Court of the United States on behalf of SDS.
SDS, the Students for Democratic Society.
Students for Democratic, which was the left-wing student group back in those days, and it was the case was called, I have it written down here in my Healy versus James. James was the president of a branch of the Connecticut State College system, and they had refused to allow a local group to organize on campus as an SDS membership organization. I won the case. And it was a good First Amendment decision, actually. I think it was unanimous, if I'm not mistaken. In any case, that was one of the cases I argued there. Another one, as we already discussed, was Phil Agee's passport case. Another Vietnam-related case that I argued and won was called Osterreich versus Selective Service. And Osterreich was he was in a public protest against the war, and Louis Hershey, who was head of the Selective Services system for a long time, personally ordered him to lose his draft board to change his status from exempt student to 1A. And somehow or other, he got to the ACLU. I took the case, and I litigated. It was out in Wyoming. Actually, and I litigated it up to the Supreme Court and won that case also. You notice I'm only talking about the cases that I won, not the ones that I lost. That was a good decision also. Another case I argued, which was of some interest in involving abortion rights, in which I had I played a bit of a role in the early days of that issue, was called Bigelow versus Virginia. A newspaper in Virginia carried an advertisement about the availability of abortion services in New York, and the publisher or editor was indicted for violating a Virginia law prohibiting abortion there. And they got to the ACLU, and I took on that case and took it to the Supreme Court and won that case, actually, and got a reversal. And they held the newspaper had a First Amendment right to run advertisements about the availability of abortion out of state. Those were a couple of the cases that I litigated in the Supreme Court of the United States. But
before we go to the next case, I just want to give
people, I'm not going to the next case.
What I want to mention again is Healy versus James, which is where you got the right of SDS to organize a chapter. What it says in the case,
Central Connecticut State College.
Right, but I think you and our listeners will get some kick out of the opening paragraph, which basically says, "We mentioned briefly at the outset the setting in 69 and 1970. A climate of unrest prevailed on many college campuses. Widespread civil disobedience, accompanied by seizure of buildings, vandalism, and arson. Some colleges had been shut down altogether, while at others files were looted and manuscripts destroyed. SDS chapters on some of these campuses had been a catalytic force during this period."
Exactly.
You were representing a catalytic force, Mel.
At least.
Sounds like a car engine. But anyway, that gives you a sense of the times and where you were going in front of the court, which would have been in some way hostile to SDS, I would assume.
Well, I remember that I had a pretty good reception in that case, as a matter of fact. Vastly different than the reception I had arguing Phil Agee's passport case, as a matter of fact.
Mel, so you took some bruises by some of these judges, and I wanted to ask you, the various judges on the Supreme Court that you had to deal with, which ones did you admire the most?
Oh, well, our favorite Catholic, Thurgood Marshall, Brennan, those were, and in his day, the former KKK or Black, Douglas. I mean, those were the, and Warren, of course. And, you know, that was the core of the liberal Supreme Court in its day from, you know, the late 50s to the middle 60s or something along
that line. What's sad is a lot of us grew up with that court.
Until Berger took over. What'd you say?
We grew up with that court, so we had great expectations of going forward as law students and lawyers that we were going to have a great court. Yeah. And then it took a dive. Well, now, most of your cases were argued during that period?
I argued the first one in 63 and the last one in 82. Oh. So it spanned that. It spanned that era. But those were the days, even with that very good court, they were not as helpful in communist Smith Act cases as they were for Black-related cases. And our mantra was, if you're red, you lose. If you're Black, you win. Okay. That was true even of the Warren Court, actually.
Well, the judge I worked for, Constance Baker Motley, argued 10 cases like you in front of the Supreme Court, all having
she
to do.
She won them all, probably.
9 out of 10. So it just tells you how, at least at that point, the court was going to give its imprimatur to civil rights, Black civil rights.
Yeah, they were very good on that issue. But I think they still upheld the membership provision of the... No, they eventually threw out the membership provision of the Subversive Activities Control Act, actually.
Well, now, Mel, you know, the Supreme Court and lower federal courts as well have gotten to be so bad, that there's discussion, Michael and I can report from the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, that people are talking about, well, what can we do and not have to go to court? So what's your take on why things got to be the way they are?
Oh, perfectly clear. The presidents who appointed these right-wing guys wanted a different court, wanted to go to the other end of the spectrum, the Warren Court. And I would like to take this opportunity, since I'm on the air and speaking publicly, to say that I think that, what's his name? Who's the worst judge on the Supreme Court?
Scalia.
Scalia is the worst judge in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's a pointy-headed, right-wing. He's the worst guy, and Thomas is the second worst Supreme Court justice in the history of the world.
I would think that Scalia
is a disgrace. A disgrace to the business. I don't know why Ruth Ginsburg is so friendly with him. They both like the opera, but if I were her, I'd stay away.
You know, when you go to arguments there, and you see it's terrible because I go to those cases. And half the argument is, you know, Scalia doing intellectual bullshit, or BS, rather, for this radio station, with the lawyers who are arguing. It doesn't mean anything. He just tries to care. He's just terrible. He takes all the time and just talks and talks. Scalia, in my opinion, is very comfortable in that specter of opinion we could call Catholic fascism, you know, right out of Franco. And I just read an interview with him in a magazine where he told the interview that he believes in the devil. And he also has said that he believes that God supports the death penalty. So, and this guy is like one of the main judges.
No, he's a lunatic. He's another right-wing lunatic with which the country is presently infested for some reason or other. If anyone can explain that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Any writings you want to point people to? Anything? I know you've not been a very prolific writer, but somewhat.
Well, my favorite piece is an article I published in The Nation some years ago, which was, in fact, there was a case called Poe versus Ulmer, which was an early Supreme Court case involving the use of the availability of contraceptives in Connecticut. And I wrote an amicus brief for the ACLU in that case, Poe v. Ulmer, which Justice Harlan, and I based it on the right to privacy, the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. Harlan picked it up in his concurring opinion in Poe v. Allman, which ultimately got picked up by the Supreme Court and became the basis for the Roe versus Wade. And I described my thought process and my creative process, quote unquote, of developing that argument in Poe versus Allman in an interesting article published in The Nation in the 70s sometime, actually. Anybody wants a copy? Well, you can Google it and get it.
Well, Mel Wolf.
anything else I can tell you? Can I tell you about why the only corporations I ever represented in my legal career were publishing companies, which were a special exception to my rule that I don't do corporate law?
Well, that's great. You know, one of my heroes is Edmund Wilson, the finest literary critic, I think. And Edmund Wilson's father was a lawyer in New Jersey.
Yes.
And he refused to represent corporations. When his friend Woodrow Wilson became president, the family had every expectation that Mr. Wilson would go to the Supreme Court. That never happened. But it didn't hurt him to not represent corporations.
No, Edmund Wilson is a towering figure.
Well, Mel Wolf, thank you very much. And hopefully in a few years we'll be able to get Ed Snowden's passport back, reverse the AG decision, and maybe have a different country.
Perhaps. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mel Wolf, you're truly a lawyer you'll like, and we appreciate having you on the show.
Very likable.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some outlets report that the White House designation of people in boats in the Caribbean, and now we understand in the Pacific, as drug smugglers, therefore unlawful combatants, therefore legitimate targets in the war on terror, therefore undeserving of due process, well, that raises legal questions. That's corporate news media speak for we're going to wait till the White House comes up with some language we can report as making some kind of sense so we can pose it against everyone else who's saying what the actual hell is going on here. Even the resignation of the head of the U.S. Southern Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in Latin America, didn't seem to move corporate reporters beyond scratching their heads over how this bombing campaign might be legal, rather than discussing what tools we have to respond to wildly illegal actions by government officials. We'll talk with Jeffrey Stein, he's staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, about efforts for minimally transparency on these lethal actions that look to be expanding by the day. Also on the show, when it comes to airlines and other companies mining your personal data to suss out how much you can possibly pay so they can charge you precisely that and no less, news media have a choice. They can write, like USA Today, about how AI might make airline pricing more complex. That's an explainer that explains that in answer to how airlines price tickets, quote, a shrugging emoticon is appropriate, close quote. And it ends with, no joke, trust your gut. Or you can do what our guest has been doing. Ask why industries are talking about saving consumers money with AI surveillance pricing, while at the same time telling their investors how they're maximizing revenue by pushing consumers to their pain point. How does that square? And who's standing up for consumers since it doesn't square? We'll hear from reporter Katya Schwenk on that story. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair. So here's the top of this October 20th Reuters piece. Quote, when two alleged drug traffickers survived a U.S. military strike last week in the Caribbean, they left the Trump administration with a decision to make, send them back home or find a way to keep them detained. Close quote. There's already a lot going on there. Alleged drug traffickers, so not tried or convicted, and they survived, which means that other people not tried or convicted of drug trafficking were killed. In a military strike, okay, even if they're drug traffickers, why is the U.S. military doing the thing? And then in the Caribbean, so does the U.S. control that region? And after all that's been transmitted without friction in a single clause, we as readers are to interest ourselves in the matter of how the Trump administration can figure out a way to sell the action and the more like it we can presumably expect. The headline, in Trump's drug war, prisoners may be too much of a legal headache, experts say. Now this, things as they are, is not even the worst kind of piece. It poses questions anyway, but the questions are about how the administration might use the law more skillfully to address the complex set of legal and political problems experts say accrue when you kill people your country is not at war with and who have faced no judge or jury. Not everyone is waiting on the White House to puzzle up a new line to sell about why the U.S. military killing unconvicted foreign people on charges they will never see is not just okay, but as J.D. Vance puts it, the highest and best use of our military. Jeffrey Stein is staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, they're pressing the administration for transparency on this. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jeffrey Stein.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's leap right into the moment. What is your FOIA request aimed at specifically, and then more broadly in terms of public awareness and potential resistance to these, let's call them extra legal Caribbean strikes?
Sure. Yeah. So as you just mentioned, since early September, President Trump has ordered at least 9 lethal strikes on private vessels in the international waters, reportedly killing up to 37 people. President Trump has claimed, without providing any evidence at all, that the victims of these strikes are quote-unquote terrorists, but the government's own disclosures indicate that the victims were, as you were just saying, merely suspected of drug smuggling. So put another way, the government's own disclosures demonstrate that these strikes are not lawful. It's flagrantly illegal under both domestic and international law to summarily kill civilians who are suspected of committing crimes. And for this reason, members of Congress from across the political spectrum, former government officials who served in presidential administrations of both parties, international bodies, and numerous civil society organizations have all agreed that these strikes, constitute murder, pure and simple. Notwithstanding this broad bipartisan consensus, however, the Trump administration is claiming that these strikes are lawful. The president sent a notice to Congress earlier this month saying that he had unilaterally determined that the United States is in a non-international armed conflict with certain gangs and drug cartels that he has also unilaterally designated as terrorist organizations. He's also claimed, again, without any evidence, that the victims of these lethal strikes are, quote, affiliated with these organizations and are thus unlawful combatants against whom the United States may use lethal force. The problem is that even if the victims of these strikes were affiliated with drug cartels, and again, the government has not provided any evidence to support that claim, there's simply no plausible argument that the United States is in an armed conflict with drug cartels. And under international law, an armed conflict between a state and a non-state actor, you know, exists only if the non-state actor is an organized armed group that's engaged in protracted armed violence against the state. And that's simply not the case here. Nonetheless, you know, according to some recent media reports, the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC, an office whose opinions are treated as binding within the executive branch, they produced a memo that reportedly authorizes lethal strikes against a secret and wide-ranging list of cartels and suspected drug traffickers, you know, apparently including those who are not affiliated with an organization that's been designated as a terrorist organization. And even as, you know, the Trump administration has repeatedly asserted that these lethal strikes against suspected drug traffickers are on firm legal ground, they've kept OLC's legal reasoning secret. And we think that's a very serious problem, you know, given the life or death stakes of the president's use of force. And we think that the public really deserves to know how our government is justifying these strikes as lawful. And we think that it's really imperative that this transparency comes, you know, immediately. The public should be able to, you know, read the government's legal justifications right now while there's still, you know, an opportunity to stop these illegal and dangerous strikes and hold government officials accountable.
Well, so why are you forced to put in a FOIA request? What's the blockage there?
So the government has not disclosed its legal reasoning, even though, you know, members of Congress have asked various officials within the executive branch what they think the legal authority under which they are operating is. The Trump administration has not released this secret memo that we think, you know, the American people are entitled to read. And so that's why we've submitted a FOIA request and are demanding that transparency, which we think is a necessary precondition to holding government officials accountable.